Tavi could be gone forever. He, too, could...
No, Isana said aloud.
She took a breath, steeling herself. She could not let Cord's viciousness kill her brother and Tavi all in one moment. She lifted her head and focused on old Bitter.
No, this isn't over. Get him into the tub.
Bitter looked up at Isana, her expression startled.
What?
Get him into the tub, Isana said. She started rolling up her sleeves in brisk, short motions.
Otto, Roth, get over here and prepare your furies.
Isana,
Bitter hissed.
Child, you cannot do this.
She can,
said Otto, his voice quiet, his pate gleaming in the light of the fire.
It's been done before. When I was young, just taking my own chain, Harold the Younger's boy fell through the ice and into the mill pond. He was under for nearly 30 minutes before we could get him back up through it, and he lived.
Lived, spat Bitter. He sat in a chair drooling and never speaking again until fevers took him. Would you do that to Bernard as well?
Roth grimaced and put a frail hand on Otto's shoulder.
She's right. Even if we bring his body back, his mind might not come along with it.
Isana stood and faced the two men.
I need him, she said. Tavi is out in the storm. I have no time to discuss the matter. You are willing to help me a moment ago. Now do it, or get out of my way. We'll help,
Otto offered at once. Roth let out a slow breath, his expression reluctant.
Aye, he agreed. Fury's willing, the attempt won't kill you. I'm touched by your enthusiasm.
Isana stalked to the copper tub. Several of the holders, under Bitter's direction, lowered Bernard's limp form into the tub. The water stained pink, blood swirling languidly out from the wound in his thigh. Get the bandage off, she instructed. It won't matter now, one way or the other. She knelt down by the head of the tub, reaching out to rest her fingers against Bernard's temples. Rill, she whispered, reaching a hand down to touch the water briefly. Rill, I need you. She felt the water swirl slowly as Rill entered the tub. She could feel the fury's reluctance, its motions vague and unsure. No, not Rill's reluctance, but her own weariness. As tired as Isana was, doubtless Rill could not hear her clearly, could not respond to her as well as the fury usually might. In a moment more, that would not be an issue.
Immy, Otto whispered.
Isana felt the portly steadholder rest his hand on her shoulder, warm fingers tightening slightly in support. The waters stirred beneath her fingers anew as the second fury entered the tub, a much smaller, more active presence than Rill's. Roth put his hand on her opposite shoulder.
Almia?
Once again, the water stirred with a stronger, more confident presence, the older steadholder's fury carrying with it a sense of fluid strength. Isana took a deep breath, focusing through her weariness and her fear and her anger. She pushed her wild concern for Tavi from her thoughts, her uncertainty that she could help her brother. She cleared everything away but her sense through Rill of the water in the tub and of the body it surrounded. There was a certain feel to a body submerged in water, a kind of delicate vibration spreading out from the skin. Isana willed Rill to surround Bernard so that she could feel for that fragile energy around him, the tremors of life. For a terrible moment the waters were still and she could sense nothing. Then Rill quivered in response to the barest traces of life in the wounded man. Isana felt her heart lurch in relief, and she murmured, "He's still here, but we have to hurry."
"Don't risk it, Isana," Roth said, his voice quiet. "He's too far gone."
"He's my brother," Isana said.
She flattened her hands against either side of Bernard's thick neck. "You and Otto seal up the wound. I'll do the rest." She felt Otto's hand tighten on her shoulder. Roth let out a quiet, resigned sigh.
"If you go in, you might not be able to get back out again.
even if you are successful in reviving him.
I know. Isana closed her eyes and leaned forward enough to plant a gentle kiss on her brother's head.
All right, then, she said.
Here we go.
Isana let out her breath in a long, slow exhalation and poured her attention, her focus, her will forward into the water. The dull ache in her limbs faded away. The clenching tension in her back vanished. All the sensations of her body, from the too cool skin beneath her fingers to the smooth stone beneath her knees and toes, faded away to nothing. She felt only the water, the fading energy around Bernard, and the nebulous presence of the Furies in the water with her. Rill's presence pressed close to her, something like concern pressing against Isana's awareness. She touched Rill with her thoughts, giving the Fury an image, a task. In response, Rill glided closer into the same space Isana's awareness occupied. The sensation of the Fury's presence overlapped with her own until she could no longer readily distinguish the two. Isana felt a brief surge of disorientation as she and the Fury joined one another. Then, as always, Rill's perceptions began to flow into her in a slow rush of sounds, murky vision, and in surges of tangible, tactile emotion. She looked up at the vague, pale shape of Bernard's body, at the even more blurred shape of her own standing over him. Roth's and Otto's Furies hovered anxiously before her in the water, each visible to her now, faint colours in a pair of cloudy forms. She did not speak, but from here it was a simple matter to send the words to Roth and Otto through their Furies. "Gather him up and seal closed the wound. I'll handle the rest." The other two Furies swirled off at once, gathering together the scarlet droplets of blood that had begun spreading into the bathwater and shepherding them back to the gaping rent in Bernard's thigh. Isana didn't wait for the Furies to complete their task. She instead slipped closer to the fading aura around her brother, focusing upon it and upon the much stronger thrum of life in the body touching Bernard, her own. She knew that what she was to attempt was dangerous. The anima of life was never simple to touch or easy to manipulate. It was a force as potent and unpredictable as life itself, and as fragile. But dangerous or not, it had to be done. She had to try. Isana reached out and made contact with that faint, fading quiver of life around Bernard. And then, touching upon that of her own body, above him, she gathered both together and melded them, blended them, drew upon the energy of her body to surround both of them to an immediate violent response. Bernard's body convulsed in the water, a sudden thrash of motion that moved every muscle in him at once. His back contorted, and Isana felt more than saw his eyes fly wide open and unseeing. His heart contracted with a heavy, unsteady thumping sound, followed by another and another. Isana felt a thrill of exhilaration fly through her, and with Rill, poured into Bernard through the wound in his leg, a rush of sudden confinement, a sense of herself stretching down hundreds of blood vessels, spreading through him, her awareness fracturing into a multitude of layers. She felt his weary heart, the bone-deep ache of his limbs, the terrifying cold of oncoming death. She felt his confusion, his frustration, his fear, the emotions pressing like a knife against her heart. She felt his body struggling against the injuries, failing, dying. What she did next was not a process of logical thought, of stimulus and response, of procedure and reason. Her thoughts were too far divided, too many, too much to direct so clearly. Everything relied on her instinct, on her ability to release conscious will and to reach through him, sensing every part of the whole and then acting to restore it. She felt it as a pressure building up against her, as steely chains of tension that closed in upon her myriad thoughts with a slow and steady inevitability, shutting them down, crushing them into stillness. She fought against that stillness, fought to keep her awareness, her life sparkling in every part of Bernard's wounded body. She threw herself into the struggle, straining against death, while around her, through her, within her, she felt every wavering, uncertain beat of his too laboured heart. She held on to his life, as she felt Roth and Otto's furies send blood back into his battered body. She held on to him as the two watercrafters went to work upon the injury itself, closing the ragged wound and crafting the very fabric of his flesh together again. She held on with all of her strength, and in a horrible space between one heartbeat and the next, realized that she could hold on no longer. She was losing him. Through Rill she felt Roth's silent urging to withdraw, to flow back out of her brother and to her own body, to save herself. She refused, drawing more heavily on the energy of her body, feeding it to Bernard, to his laboring heart. She sent everything she could reach coursing into him, and felt it flowing out of her somewhere, felt herself growing weaker. She gave her brother all that she was, her love of him, her love for Tavi, terror at the prospect of his death, frustration, agony, fear, the joy of glowing memories, and the despair of the darkest moments of her life. She held back nothing. Bernard quivered again, and abruptly gasped in a breath of air that filled his lungs like cold fire. He coughed, and the horrible stillness abruptly fractured and fled as his lungs labored again and again and again. Isana felt relief flood over her as his body grew stronger, as the energy of him began to flow again, as the rhythm of his heart began to quicken and become regular, a hammer pulse that coursed through her awareness. She felt Rill dimly, as the fury moved through him, and felt her gentle confusion. Once again Roth attempted to send something to her through their furies, but she was too tired to understand it, too lost in relief and exhaustion to understand. She let her awareness drift, felt herself sinking down into a darkness, into warmth that promised her rest from all of her anxiety and pain and weariness. And then a dull fire pulsed in her. She thought that she remembered the sensation from some time long before. Her descent slowed for a moment. Again the fire came, and again, and again. Pain. I am feeling pain. In a detached, remote, and unconcerned part of her awareness, she understood what was happening. Roth had been right. She had given too much of herself, and had been unable to return to her own body. Too tired, too relaxed, too weak. She would die back there beside the tub, her body simply slumping to the floor and empty of life. The fire flared again, somewhere back up and away from the darkness. The dead feel no pain, she thought. Pain is for the living. She reached out toward it, toward that fire in the night. The delicious descent halted, though part of her screamed out against it. She reached back for the pain, but did not move, did not begin to rise again. It is too late. I cannot go back. She tried, regardless. She struggled against the stillness, the warmth. She struggled to live. Sudden light flared like a newborn sun above her. Isana reached for it, embraced that distant fire with every part of her that still lived. It washed over her in a flood and became an instant blazing torment, horrible and bright, an agony more searing than anything she had ever known. She felt a dizzying, wrenching sensation and a sudden rush of confusion, of emptiness where Rill had been before, of more and more pain. She went back into it, and gladly. The light, the agony, became all-consuming, her limbs aching, her lungs burning with her ragged breath, her head pounding, and her mind screaming as raw sensation poured into it. She heard shouts. Someone was screaming and there was a heavy thump of impact. Then more screams. Fade, she thought. There, someone shouted. Otto, look, she's breathing. Get a blanket, replied Roth's steady voice. And another for Bernard. Broth for both. They'll need food. I know that. Someone get that idiot slave out of here before he hurts someone else. The general cloud of pain over her began to resolve itself by slow degrees to a dull throb in her hand, and a sweet and oddly satisfying ache of exhaustion spread throughout her. She opened her eyes and turned her head to one side to see Bernard looking blearily around him. She fumbled her hand toward him and saw the fingers of it swollen and oddly shaped. She touched him, and the pain swept down on her, blinded her.
"Easy, Asana."
Roth took her wrist and gently pressed her hand back down.
"Easy, you need to rest."
"Tavi,"
Asana said. She struggled to force out the words, though they sounded blurry, even to her.
"Find Tavi."
"Rest,"
Roth said. The old steadholder looked down on her with gentle, compassionate eyes.
"Rest. You've done too much already."
Bitter appeared beside Asana and assured her,
"We'll get the steadholder back on his feet by morning, child. He'll take care of everything. Rest now."
Asana shook her head. She couldn't rest. Not while the storm raged outside. Not while Tavi remained in it, helpless and fragile and alone. She started to sit up, but simply could not. She did not have the strength to do much more than lift her head. She fell back to the floor and felt a tear of frustration glide from one eye. That tear seemed to trigger others, and then she was weeping, silently, weeping until she could not see, could barely breathe. She should have been more careful. She should have forbidden him to leave the steadholt this morning. She should have seen to her brother more swiftly, should have understood the cordholder's plans before it had come to violence. She had fought as hard as she could. She had tried. Furies knew she had tried. But all of her efforts had been for nothing. Time had swept down on her, swift as a hungry crow. Tavi was out there in the storm, alone.
"Oh, furies and spirits of the departed, please, please let him come home safe."
Chapter 12 Amara strove to ignore the exhaustion and the cold. Her limbs shook almost too hard to be controlled, and her entire body throbbed with weariness. More than anything, she wanted to collapse upon the floor and sleep. But if she did, it might cost the boy his life. She had wiped the mud from his face and his throat as best she could, but it clung to him in a thin layer of slimy clay, grey, brown, and mottled over paler skin. It made him look almost like a corpse. Several days old. Amara slipped a hand beneath the boy's shirt, feeling for his heartbeat. Even in this weather he wore only a light tunic and cloak for warmth, evidence of his hardy upbringing, here on the savage frontier of the realm. She shuddered, soaked and half-frozen, and glanced up yearningly toward the nearest of the funeral fires. The boy's heartbeat thudded against her own mud-stained palm, quick and strong. But when she drew her hand out, she saw the mud dappled with bright scarlet. The boy was wounded, though it couldn't have been anything major. He'd have been dead already. Amara cursed under her breath and felt for his limbs. They were dangerously cold. While she struggled to force her weary mind to decide on a course of action, she began rubbing briskly, at once scraping more of the frigid mud off of him, and attempting to restore warmth and circulation to his limbs. She called his name several times, but though his eyelashes flickered, his eyes did not open, nor did he speak. She took a quick look around the chamber. Amara shuddered to think of what the mud of the Field of Tears, where so many had fallen, might do to him if it got into his blood. She had to clean it off, and quickly. She undressed him roughly. He was too limp and heavy for all his slender appearance to allow her weakened hands to be any more precise. His clothes tore in a few places before she got them off of him, and by the time she had, his lips had tinged with blue. Amara half-carried, half-dragged him over to the water and then down into it. The water's warmth came as a pleasant shock to her senses. The pool's floor sloped down sharply until it was about hip-deep, and even as she kept the boy's face out of the water, she sank gratefully into it and simply huddled there for a moment, until the rattle of her teeth chattering had begun to slow down. Then she dragged him a few feet to one side, out of the mud-clouded water and began to rub roughly over his skin, brushing the clay away until the boy was clean. He had a shocking collection of bruises, scrapes, abraded skin, and minor cuts. The bruises were fairly fresh, only a few hours old, she judged. His knees had several layers of skin peeled off, apparently a match to the ragged holes in his discarded trousers. His arms, legs, and flanks all showed patches of purple, slowly forming, as though he had been recently beaten, and a lattice of long, tiny cuts covered his skin. He had to have been running through thickets and thorns. She cleared the mud from his face as best she could, using her already torn skirts to clean him, and then dragged him back up out of the water and over to one of the fires. As soon as she felt the air on her, she began to shiver again, and realized that the water had not been nearly so warm as it had felt. She had simply been too cold, relatively, to feel the difference. She settled the boy in a heap on the floor, as near to the fire as she could manage, and huddled there for a moment, on her heels, her arms wrapped tight around her. Her head nodded, and Amara let out a startled sound as she fell to her side. She wanted to simply surrender to the exhaustion, but she could not. Neither of them might wake up again. She felt her throat tighten on a whimper of protest, but she drove herself to her feet again, shivering nearly too hard to move, to think. Her fingers felt like lead as she struggled from her own soaked clothing, thick and nerveless and unresponsive. She let the lighter clothing fall in a sopping heap to the marble floor and staggered to one of the stone sentries facing the bier. She clawed the red cape from its shoulders and wrapped it around her. Amara allowed herself a brief respite, leaning against the wall and shivering into the cape, but then drove herself along the wall to the next statue and the one after, claiming both of those capes as well, then returning to the boy's side. With the last of her strength, she wrapped him in the scarlet cloaks, securing their warmth around him, near the fire. Then, huddled into a ball beneath the scarlet fabric of the royal guard, she leaned her head back against the wall. It took nothing more than that for her to sleep. She woke, warm and aching. The storm raged steadily, all howling winds and frozen rain. Amara pushed herself to her feet, her body weary, stiff from sleeping, crouched down on her heels, and blessedly warm beneath the heavy fabric of the cape. She moved to look out of the doorway of the chamber. Night still reigned outside. Lightning flashed and danced without, but it and the accompanying thunder seemed more distant now, sound rumbling along well after the light. The forces of the furies of the air still battled, but the winter winds had pushed their rivals to the south, away from the valley, and much of the rain that fell outside now rattled and bounced against the cooling earth as true hailstones. Gaius had to have known, Amara thought. He had to have been aware of the repercussions of calling the southern winds to bear her north to the valley. He had been crafting too long, and knew the forces that affected his realm too well for it to have been an accident. Thus clearly the First Lord had intended the storm. But why? Amara stared out at the bleak night, frowning. She would be trapped until the storm relented. And so will be anyone else in the valley, fool, she thought. Her eyes widened. Gaius, with this act, had effectively called a halt to any activity within the Calderon Valley until the storm had relented. But why? If speed had truly been of the essence, why rush her here, only to fence her off from acting? Unless Gaius felt that the opposition was already in motion. In that case, her arrival would put an effective freeze on their activities, perhaps giving her a chance to rest, regain her balance before acting. Amara frowned. Would the First Lord truly arrange such a deadly storm? A fury crafting of proportions she could scarcely visualize? Merely to allow his agent to rest? Amara shivered and wrapped the cloak around her a little more tightly. She could only deduce so much of Gaius's reasoning. He knew far more than most in Alera ever could. Most would not even begin to grasp the scope of it. He was oftentimes a subtle ruler. Rarely did his actions have only one objective, only one set of consequences. What else did her ruler have in mind? Amara grimaced. If Gaius had wanted her to know, surely he would have told her. Unless he trusted her competence to work out on her own what he intended. Or unless he still doesn't trust you. She turned away from the doorway and padded silently back into the chamber, her thoughts in a whirl. She leaned against a wall beside one of the stone guardians, denuded of his cloak, and raked her fingers through her hair. She had to get moving. Surely the enemies of the crown would not be idle once the weather broke. She had to have a plan, at least, and get to work on it right away. The first order of business, Fidelius would have said, would be to gather intelligence. She had to establish what was going on in the valley before she could effectively do anything about it, whether it be to act, to invoke her authority as a cursor of the crown to the local count, or to report back to Gaius. She swallowed. All she had to help her was the knife she'd stolen from Fidelius's boot, and some clothing far too light for the weather it seemed she would be faced with. She looked back at the boy, curled on his side before the fire, shivering. She also had him. Amara moved to the boy's side and laid a hand on his forehead. He let out a soft groan. His skin was too hot, feverish, and his breathing had dried out his lips, cracked them. She frowned and went back to the water, cupping her hands together and carrying it back to the boy. She urged him to drink and tried to tip the water into his mouth. Most of it trickled through her fingers and splashed onto his chin and neck, but he managed to swallow a little. Amara repeated the process several times until the boy seemed to relax a little, settling down again. She studied him as she fetched another of the scarlet capes, folded it into a pad and slipped it beneath his head. He was a beautiful child in many ways, his features almost delicate. His hair curled around his head, dark, glossy ringlets. He had the long, thick lashes that so many men seemed to have and not care about, and his hands had long, slender fingers that seemed entirely oversized to the rest of him, promising considerable growth yet to come. His skin, where not marred with bruises or scratches, glowed with the ruddy clarity of youth that had somehow avoided awkward adolescence. She hadn't seen what color his eyes were in the hectic events of the previous evening, but his voice had been clarion clear in the storm, bell sharp. She frowned more seriously, studying the boy. He had almost certainly saved her life, but who was he? They were a considerable walk from any of the local steadholds. She had chosen her landing site in order to avoid coming down within sight of any of the locals. So what had the boy been doing there, in the middle of nowhere, in that storm? Home, the boy murmured. Amara looked down at him, but he hadn't opened his eyes. His face twitched into a frown in his sleep.
I'm sorry, Aunt Isana. Uncle Bernard should be home. Tried to get him home safe.
Amara felt her eyes widen. Bernard Holt was the largest steadholt in the Calderon Valley. Steadholder Bernard was the boy's uncle? She leaned closer and asked him, What happened to your uncle, Tarvi? Was he hurt? Tarvi nodded, a dreamy motion.
Marat, the herd bane. Brutus stopped it, but not before it bit him.
Marat? The savages hadn't given the realm any trouble since the incident on this very site 15 or 16 years ago. Amara had felt skeptical when Gaius had voiced his concern about the Marat, but apparently one had come into the Calderon Valley and attacked an Alaran steadholder. But what did it mean? Could it have been one lone Marat warrior? A chance meeting in the wilderness? No. Too coincidental for mere chance. Something larger was underway. Amara clenched her hand on the fabric of the cape in frustration, wrinkling it. She needed more information.
Tarvi, she said,
what can you tell me of this Marat? Was he of the Herdbane tribe? Was he alone?
Had another one, the boy mumbled. Killed one, but he had another one.
A second beast?
Hmm.
Where is your uncle now?
Tavi shook his head, and his expression twisted with pain.
Here. Was supposed to be home. Sent him home with Brutus. Brutus should have brought him back.
Tears had started down his cheeks, and Amara swallowed upon seeing them.
She needed information, yes, but she couldn't torment an unconscious child for it.
He needed rest. If he was the Steadholder's nephew and the man had survived the attack, she could bring him home safely and almost certainly secure the Steadholder's enthusiastic cooperation.
"I'm sorry," the boy said, broken and still weeping quiet tears. "I tried. Sorry."
"Shh," she said.
She used an edge of the cloak to wipe the tears away. "Time to rest now. Lie down and rest, Tavi." He subsided, and she frowned down at him, smoothing his hair back from his fevered forehead while he slept. If a lone Marat was in the valley, perhaps the Steadholder had gone to hunt it down. But if so, then why would this boy be along? He had no particular skill at crafting, she judged, or he would have used it when the Windmanes had been attacking them. He bore no weapons, no equipment. He couldn't have been hunting the Marat. Amara inverted the idea. Had it hunted the folk of Bernard Holt? Possible, particularly from the Herdbane tribe, if all that she heard of the Marat was true. They were a cold and calculating people, as ruthless and deadly as the animals that accepted them as one of their own. But Marat didn't often take more than one beast as... What sufficed to describe the term? Mate? Companion? Blood sibling? She shook her head with a shiver. The savage's ways were still alien to her, something fantastic from a tale rather than the business-like reality she had learned from classes in the academy. Horde masters took more than one beast, commonly, as a symbol of status. But what would a Marat horde master be doing in the Calderon Valley? Invading. Her own silent response to the thought gave her a little chill. Could the holders have run into the advance scouts of a Marat attack force? The attack could hardly come at a more advantageous time for the enemy, Amara realized. The roads were slowly closing down for the winter season here among the northern cities. Many troops had been given winter furlough with their families, and folk of the countryside in general were winding down the frantic labor of harvest into the sedate pace of winter. If the Marat attacked the valley now, providing the forces stationed at garrison were neutralized, they could wipe out every person in it, and maraud through all the Steadholts, practically all the way back to Riva itself. They might even, if they numbered enough, simply pour around the city and into Alera's interior. Amara shuddered to imagine what a horde might accomplish in that event. She had to contact the Count at garrison, his name was Bram or Graham or something like that, and put him on the alert. But what if the boy was lying about the Marat? Or mistaken? She grimaced. She knew the local citizenry by name, at least, though the memorization of the lords and counts had been one of the more tedious chores at the academy. She had no such knowledge of this Steadholder Bernard or of the folk of the valley. By all accounts, they were a tough and independently minded folk, but she knew nothing about their reliability or lack of it. She had to talk to this Bernard. If he had indeed seen a Marat horde master and been wounded by one of the great hunting birds of the outland plains, then she had to know it, secure his support, and hopefully some new clothes with it, and act. She frowned. But she could expect the opposition to be moving as well. Fidelius had led her into a trap she had escaped by the smallest of margins. She had been pursued for several hours, and escaped the knight's heiress sent after her through skill and good fortune. Did she suppose that Fidelius would not continue the pursuit? In all probability, she realized, his business lay here, in the Calderon Valley. That had to be one of the reasons Gaius sent her here. Fidelius was her patricerus, or had been, she thought, with a bitter taste in her mouth. She knew him, perhaps, better than anyone else alive.
she had seen through his deception at the renegade camp, though only barely. What would Fidelius do? He would judge her by her previous actions, of course. He would expect her to arrive in the valley and promptly to make contact with the steadholders, coordinating information, and after suitable data had been gathered, to take action against whatever was happening, whether it meant falling into a defense within one of the strongest steadholds, or mobilizing the men of the valley and the troops of garrison to meet it. And what would he do to stop it? He'd find me, kill me, and sow confusion among the holders until his plan could begin. A slow chill went through her. She considered the situation again, but it was perfectly typical of Fidelius. He preferred simple approaches, direct solutions. Keep lies simple, he had always told her. Keep plans simple, leave them open to modification, and use your eyes, your head, more than any plan. Word of a cursor in the valley would spread among the holders like wildfire. She might as well paint a circle over her heart and wait for an arrow to soar into its center. A slow chill crawled through her. He would kill her now. Fidelius had given her a chance, and she had made him suffer for it. He would not allow himself to make the same mistake again. Her teacher would kill her without a moment's hesitation if she got in his way again.
"That's what I'm here to do," she whispered.
She started shivering again. Though she tried to tell herself that it was not fear coloring her decision, she felt it, tickling at her belly, racing with cold spider fingers up and down her spine. She could not allow herself the luxury of openly invoking her authority and revealing herself to Fidelius. To do so would be to invite her own death, swift and certain. She had to remain quiet, as covert as possible. A runaway slave would be a far less unusual occurrence here at the frontier than an emissary of the crown warning of possible invasion. She couldn't allow her identity to be known until she knew who she could trust, who could give her information that would let her act decisively. To do any less would be to invite her own death, and possibly disaster upon the valley. She looked down at the boy, her thoughts still in a tangle. He hadn't needed to come and help her the previous evening, but he had. The boy had courage, even if he lacked some more life-preserving common sense, and she had little choice but to be glad that he did. That said something of him, and in turn of the folk who had raised him. In his sleep, in his fever, he had spoken not to a mother or a father, but to his aunt, whose name apparently was Isana. An orphan? Amara mused, and as she did, her belly rumbled. She rose to her feet and padded among the trees planted around the pool. As she expected, she found more than a few fruit-bearing trees among them. Gaius never acted with a single consequence in mind, when he could manage several at once. In creating this memoriam for his fallen son, he had raised a spectacular tribute to the princeps' memory, reminded the High Lords exactly what power he commanded, and provided a place of refuge for himself or for his agents all at the same time. She picked fruit from the trees and ate, studying the area around her. Amara went to the statues. They had been armed with genuine shields and with weapons, the short, vicious blades of the royal guard, meant to be used in close quarters to incapacitate or kill in a single blow. She slid one from its sheath and tested it. Its edge proved to be keen, and she returned it to its resting place. Food, shelter, and arms. Gaius was a paranoid old fox, and she was glad for it. Her arm twinged as she slid the sword back, and she glanced at the dirtied bandage on it. She retrieved the knife from her discarded skirts and cut a fresh bandage from them. She dried it first near one of the fires before cutting the old one off, cleaning the wound with fresh water and applying fresh wrappings. Something else tugged at her attention, but she pushed it firmly away. There was work to be done. Amara moved quickly then, making sure the boy was sleeping peacefully. She gathered fruit onto one of the shields, using it as a platter, and rested it near him. She washed their clothing in the pool and used branches from the small trees to dry them over one of the other fires.
She called upon the weary Cirrus to stand guard around the memoriam and to warn her should anyone approach. And when those chores were done, she found a smooth stone among the soil of the plants and used it to hone the edge of her knife. That was when the tears took her. When the memories of years of instruction, conversation, of life shared with the man who had been her teacher came rolling back over her. She had loved him in her own way, loved the danger of her work, loved the experiences he shared with her, loved the life to which she had been called. He had known how much being a cursor meant to Amara. He had known and he had done everything to help her with her studies, with graduating from the academy. He did everything except tell you the truth. Amara felt the tears rising and she let them come. It hurt. It hurt to think that he had turned against the realm, that he had in that single act of treachery endangered all that she had struggled to achieve, to fight to protect. He had declared his life's purpose as a cursor to be empty, meaningless, and by extension, hers as well. His actions, not his words, said that it all had been a hollow, vicious lie. No matter what happened to Amara, she would stop him. Whatever he had planned, however he had justified it, Fidelius was a traitor. That cold fact struck her through the heart again and again. The knife whispered it as the stone glided along the blade's edge, the steel wetted with her own tears. Traitor. Traitor. She would stop him. She had to stop him. Amara did not let herself make a sound. She buried the sobs in her belly until her throat ached with the pain of holding them back. She blinked the tears from her eyes and honed the edge of the little knife until it gleamed in the light from the fire. Chapter 13. Before noon of the next day, the knight's heiress brought Fidelius, together with Aldric the Sword and the mad Odiana, down into the western end of the Calderon Valley. Grey clouds hung low and glowering overhead, though their threat was an empty one. The storm that had preceded them during the previous night had already headed off to the south, where distant thunder could only barely be heard. They were attired warmly against the near winter cold of the valley, and breath steamed before every mouth. Fidelius stepped from the litter with a grimace and demanded of the captain of the contingent of knights, "You are certain that no one has arrived?" The man murmured something into the air, then tilted his head to one side, his eyes abstracted, listening. He nodded a moment later and said, "Levis reports that there are still Marat scouts moving here and there. None of our observers saw anyone new coming into the valley." "That wasn't the question," Fidelius said. He heard the sharp edge in his own voice. "The last thing we need is an envoy of the Crown rousing garrison or bringing in reinforcements from Riva." The captain shook his head. "The storm last night was long and extremely violent. No one could remain out in it and live. I suppose it's possible that someone skilled could have come in under it, if they could have gotten to cover quickly enough. She could." Fidelius cut off a reply with a wave of his hand. "The crows take Gaius and everyone with him. He always loved to show off, even when creating distractions."
"Someone's a grumpy boy this morning,"
Odiana murmured to Aldric. The big swordsman debarked the litter and turned to lift the shapely woman lightly from it to the ground. The water witch gave Fidelius a smirk that fairly smouldered with sensuality and pressed herself against Aldric's side, beneath the curve of his arm.
"One would think that he hadn't gotten enough sleep last night, love."
"Peace," Aldric rumbled, the thick fingers of one huge hand sliding over her mouth, a casual motion. The woman's eyes closed and she let out a happy sigh. Fidelius ignored the barb from the woman and said to the captain,
"This is no time to get sloppy. Give the girl's description to our men in Riva. If she comes through, stop her, quietly. The same if any of the other curses I've described to you show themselves."
The captain nodded.
"And what do I tell the men here? The same. If you see someone unfamiliar in the air, kill them. It shouldn't take me long to make contact with our source. Then we move."
The captain nodded.
We were fortunate to have the wind last night, sir. We were able to bring in more men than we thought would be available. Fortunate.
Fidelius laughed and tried to ignore the tension burning in his stomach.
That wind brought the storm and with it one of the Crown's own, Captain. I would not be so certain it was such a blessing.
The captain saluted stiffly and took a step back. He murmured something else to the air, then beckoned with a hand to the knights supporting the poles of the litter. The men rose in a sudden column of rising wind and soared into the air and through the concealing underbelly of the clouds above within a few moments. Aldrich waited until they were well gone to say laconically,
"You may have been a little hard on them. If the Crown wanted to craft someone into the valley, nothing they could have done would have stopped him." "You don't know Gaius," Fidelius replied. "He is neither all-knowing nor infallible. We should have moved last night."
"We'd have arrived amidst the storm," the swordsman pointed out. "It could have killed us."
"Yes, the nasty storm," Odiana murmured. "And then, too, ex-cursor, you would not have been given enough time to enjoy the pretty slave child."
The last few words of the sentence dripped with a kind of gloating glee. The woman smiled, her eyes sparkling, as Aldrich absently covered her mouth with his hand again. She bit at his fingers, letting out a soft growl, and the swordsman let her, a smile touching his mouth. Fidelius stared hard at the water witch. She knew. He couldn't be sure how much she knew about Aquitaine's wife and the aftermath of the dismal little scene the previous evening, but he could see knowledge glittering in her eyes. His belly burned a bit more as he considered the possible consequences, should Aquitaine learn of his wife's liaison with Fidelius. Aquitaine seemed the type to overlook the forest for the trees at times, but he would surely have little patience with anyone who would risk humiliating him by lying with his wife. The few bites of biscuit Fidelius had managed to get down during the flight threatened to come hurtling up again. He kept the tension off of his face and thought that he would have to do something about the water witch. She was fast becoming a liability. Fidelius gave her a flat, neutral little smile and said,
"I think we should focus on the task at hand."
"Seems pretty straightforward," Aldrich commented. "Get on the horses, ride to the meeting point, talk to the savage, ride out again."
Fidelius glanced around and then murmured for Vama to fetch the horses. The earth fury moved beneath his right foot, a stirring in the ground of acknowledgement, and vanished.
"I don't anticipate that the ride will be a problem. The savage might."
Aldrich shrugged. "He won't be a problem."
The former cursor began tugging on his riding gloves.
"You think your sword will alter anything for him?"
"It can alter all sorts of things."
Fidelius smiled.
"He's Marat. He isn't human. They don't think the same way we do."
Aldrich squinted at him, almost frowning.
"He won't be intimidated by you. He regards your sword as something dangerous. You'll just be the soft, weak thing holding it."
Aldrich's expression didn't change. Fidelius sighed.
"Look, Aldrich, the Marat don't have the same notion of individuality that we do. Their whole culture is based around totems. Their tribes are built upon commonality of totem animals. If a man has a powerful totem, then he is a formidable man. But if the man has to hide behind his totem instead of fighting beside it, then it makes him somewhat contemptible. They've called us the Dead Tribe. They regard armor and weaponry as our totem. Dead Earth. We hide behind our dead totems rather than going into battle beside them. Do you see?"
"No,"
Aldrich stated.
He slipped Odiana from his side and started to draw on his gloves, unconcerned.
"That doesn't make any sense."
"Not to you," Fidelius said. "It makes perfect sense to a Marat."
"Savages,"
Aldrich commented.
Odiana turned to the packs and drew his scabbarded sword from it. He held out his hand without looking, and she slipped the weapon into it,
then watched as the swordsman buckled it on. "What happens if he doesn't cooperate?"
"Leave that to me," Fidelius said.
Aldrich raised his eyebrows.
"I mean it. Keep your weapon at your side unless everything goes to the crows. And if it does, kill everything that isn't you, me, or the witch."
Aldrich smiled.
"What do I do?"
Odiana asked. Her duty to Aldrich done, she wandered a few paces away, drawing the toe of her shoe through the mud, lifting her heavier, warmer skirts enough to be able to study the buckles.
"Just keep an eye on the Marat. If you feel them get angry, warn us."
Odiana frowned and looked up at Fidelius. She placed a hand on the shapely curve of one hip and said,
"If Aldrich gets to kill someone, I should get to as well. It's only fair."
"Perhaps," Fidelius said.
"I didn't get to kill anyone last night. It's my turn."
"We'll see."
Odiana stamped her foot on the ground and folded her arms, scowling.
"Aldrich!"
The big man went to her, taking off his cape and absently slipping it over her shoulders. The fabric could have wrapped around her twice.
"Quiet, love. You know I'll let you have what you want."
She smiled up at him, winsome.
"Truly?"
"Don't I always?"
He bent to the woman and kissed her, one arm pressing her against him. Her full lips parted willingly to his mouth, her body arching against his, and she reached up a hand to rake her nails through his hair, evidently delighted. Fidelius rubbed at the bridge of his nose, where tension had begun to gather into a headache, and walked a short distance away. The horses arrived a moment later, nudged into a calm walk by Vama, and subtly guided over the ground. Fidelius called to the other two, who broke from their embrace only reluctantly, and the three saddled and mounted without further discussion. As he had predicted, the ride passed uneventfully. Itan bounded along before them through the trees, the wood fury taking the form of a large, silent squirrel, always just far enough into the shadows to be seen only in faint outline. Fidelius followed the bounding, flickering shape of his fury without the need for conscious effort. He had been using Itan to track for him and guide him since he was barely more than a boy. They crossed the Crown Causeway and rode north and east through barren woodland filled with ragged pine trees, brambles and thorns toward the glowering shape of mountain rising up several miles before them. The mountain, Fidelius remembered, as well as the pine barrens around it, had a bad reputation for being hostile to humans. Little wonder the Marat had wanted a meeting near to what would be a safe area for his kind. Fidelius flexed his right foot in the stirrup as he rode, frowning. The boot didn't fit correctly without his knife in it. He felt a faint and bitter smile stretch his lips. The girl had been brighter than he'd given her credit for. She'd seen an opportunity and exploited it ruthlessly, just as she'd been taught to do. As her patroceras, he felt an undeniable stirring of pride in her accomplishment. But as a professional, there was only a cold, tense frustration. She should have become an asset to his effort, and instead she had become a dangerously unknown factor in the play of events. If she was in the valley, there was no limit to how much havoc she could potentially wreak with his plans. And even if she wasn't, the distraction of guarding against the possibility was nothing trivial in itself. How would he disrupt the plan in motion, were he in her place? Fidelius considered it.
No.
That would be the wrong approach. He preferred short, brutal solutions to such matters, the less complicated the better. Too much could go wrong with finesse in a situation like this. Amara thought in a far less linear manner. The simplest solution would be to get to the nearest steadholder, declare her status, and dragoon everyone she could lay her hands on into spreading word through the valley that some sort of mischief was abroad. In that event, he'd have several dozen woodcrafty holders roaming about the valley, and one of them would almost certainly see something and know it for what it was. If she did that, identifying herself and her location, matters would be simpler.
A swift stroke would remove her from the equation, and he could then muddy the waters until it was too late for the holders to stop matters from proceeding. Amara would realize the danger of such a course naturally. She would need to be more circumspect than that, less linear. She would be improvising as she went along, while he would, by necessity, play the hunter, beating the bushes to force her to move, and then acting swiftly to cut off anything she might attempt. Fidelia smiled at the irony. It seemed they would both be playing to their strong suits. Well enough, then. The girl was talented, but inexperienced. She wouldn't be the first person he had outmaneuvered and destroyed. She wouldn't be the last. A flicker of motion from Itan warned Fidelius that the three riders were not alone in the grey shadows of the woods. He drew his mount to a stop at once, lifting his hand to signal the others to do the same. There was silence there among the dimness of the evergreens, broken only by the breathing of the three horses, the drip of rainwater from the trees to the forest floor, and the soft sigh of cold northern wind. Fidelius's mount threw back its head and let out a short, shrill sound of fear. The other two horses picked up on it, heads lifted high and eyes wide and white. Odiana's mount threw its head about and danced to one side, nervous and spooky. Fidelius reached out to Vama at once, and the earth fury acted upon his will, spreading to the beasts around him the soothing calm of the deep earth. Fidelius felt the Earth Fury's influence expand like a slow wave until it rippled over the horses, stealing away the restless agitation and letting their riders bring the beasts once more under control.
"Something watches,"
the Water Witch hissed. She drew her mount close to Aldrich's side, her dark eyes glittering and agate hard.
"They are hungry."
Aldrich pursed his lips, then put one hand on his sword. He didn't otherwise straighten from the relaxed slouch he had maintained during the whole ride.
"Easy," Fidelius murmured, putting a hand on his horse's neck. "Let's move forward. There's a clearing just ahead. Let's give ourselves some open space around us."
They eased the horses forward into a clearing, and though the mounts were under control, they still tossed their heads restlessly, eyes and ears flicking about for some sign of whatever enemy they had scented. Fidelius led them to the center of the clearing, though it scarcely gave them 30 feet on any side. The shadows fell thick through the trees, the wan grey light creating pools of shifting fluid dimness between branch and bough. He scanned the edges of the clearing until he spotted the vague outline of Itan's form, the squirrel-like shape flickering around the edges of a patch of dimness. Then he nudged his horse forward a step and addressed it directly.
"Show yourself. Come out to speak beneath the sun and the sky."
For a moment, nothing happened. Then a shape within that dimness resolved itself into the form of a Marat and stepped forward into the clearing. He stood tall and relaxed, his pale hair worn in a long braid across his scalp and down the nape of his neck. Dark wiry feathers had been worked into the braid. He wore a buckskin belt and loincloth about his hips, and nothing more. He bore a hook-shaped knife in his right hand, gleaming like dark glass. At his side paced a herdbane, one of the tall predator birds of the plains beyond. It more than matched the Marat in height, though its neck and legs were so thickly built with muscle as to seem stumpy and clumsy. Fidelius knew that they were not. The bird's beak gleamed in tandem with the Marat's knife, and the terrible raking claws upon its feet scratched through the bed of damp pine needles covering the forest floor and tore at the earth beneath.
"You are not Atzerak," Fidelius said.
He kept his voice measured, clear, his speech almost rhythmic.
"I seek him."
"You seek Atzerak, Chovin of the Herdbane tribe,"
the Marat said, his own guttural voice in the same cadence.
"I stand between you."
"You must stand elsewhere."
"That I will not do. You must go back."
Fidelius shook his head.
"That I will not do."
"Then there will be blood,"
the Marat said. His knife twitched, and the herdbane beside him let out a low, whistling hiss. From behind Fidelius, Odiana murmured,
"Where? He is not alone."
Fidelius followed Itan's flickering unseen guidance.